Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 101 of Registry Matters. Larry, this is like a rebirth. This is episode 1, 100 plus 1. So this is episode 1 of a new era of Registry Matters podcast.
Well, fantastic. Do you think we can do another 100, or do you think we'll be out of business?
I'm sure we can. I don't know if anybody's going to listen to it, but we could do it.
So we could do it even if there's not anyone listening.
We could be like Neil Bortz, and we could say something like, hey, if you don't want to listen, we can shut you down from our end. I could put in all kinds of MAC address filters, and I could shut people down. That's to throw some tech words out there for people that don't know them.
Well, now, when he said, we'll disconnect your radio from this end, that was in the 60s and 70s. Now, you actually could disconnect a person from this end, couldn't you?
I could to a certain degree. I could shut them down from their one place where they're coming from. If they then moved, I couldn't, it would be whack-a-mole. I could keep doing it, but it would be whack-a-mole.
Well, I think when Neil was saying it, he was just letting people know that they certainly had a choice in their listening.
I hear you. Ryan said he'll be sad if the podcast dies while he's in the lockup. He's about to go off to a 4-year vacation.
Yeah, and I want to spend some time with Ryan before he goes and make sure we stay connected at least through the newsletter or something.
Yep.
So before he goes to the chain gang.
Yeah, man, he's a good dude. He said 4-year poopcation. I've never heard poopcation before.
Well,
that's funny.
Florida prisons are not known for being very accommodating. The majority of them are not air conditioned, and it's a pretty warm climate. When you get to Florida, you're talking about very subtropical.
Yeah, and Charles says that he's going to supply him with transcripts, and also the Narsal conference folder. That's cool. If they'll let those things in too.
So, well, I hope they do, and we do have a newsletter at Narsal. We'll make sure that he gets on the list for that. I'll take care of that. The problem is, initially, when he goes through intake, we won't know where he's going to be, so he'll have to tell us where he ends up landing.
Yeah, it could be 3-ish or so months before everybody figures out where he is and mail starts getting routed to that place. It could be a decent chunk of time. It's not just going to be like, hey, your mail gets forwarded, and it's there 2 or 3 days later.
Well, in diagnostic and intake, generally, they can receive mail, but how quickly they pump them through varies from state to state. He could be there for many weeks, or he could be there for a short, very short period of time. Just depends on how quickly they do their workup. In Jackson, people stay there sometimes for many weeks before they get shipped out.
One final thing, Jackson, Ryan, I wish you
Jackson's
the best.
Jackson's in Georgia, for those who don't recognize. Yeah.
And I just wish you the best of success, man. And I hope everything is calm and cool, and everything just goes smoothly as well as it can be.
Me as well. I hope that it's never prisons are dangerous, inherently dangerous places.
And a young spry lad, not for someone that has any sort of medical ailments.
Anybody who minimizes a prison, you don't want to. When people say, "Well, what difference does a day make?" Well, I think I've said it on the podcast before. The difference a day makes is just look at the calendar in 1980. If you were in prison, and we only had one prison in our state in 1980, and if you were in the penitentiary of New Mexico on February 28th, 1980, and that was your discharge date, you walked away without any scrapes. If you were in the penitentiary of New Mexico on February 29th, one day later, that was a leap year. If you were in prison on February 29th, we had the most violent uprising in U.S. prison history, where 33 inmates were viciously slaughtered and others injured, and that day made all the difference. So prisons are volatile places, and a day could be the difference between some significant harm and not.
And I'm sure Ryan is really happy to hear that story.
I'm not trying to make people happy. I'm trying to let people know that a day makes a difference. When they say, what are you fussing about? You've done 11 years and you're fussing about a day. The day that you do that you shouldn't do could be the day that makes a significant difference.
Very true. Well, We did receive an incredibly very generous contribution from Mr. Anonymous. I won't go into the amount, but it is going to set Registry Matters onto a path of financial solvency for years to come. Thank you, Mr. Anonymous, very much.
Well, wasn't it $38,000?
It was a large, significant sum of money.
I think you might be exaggerating a tad bit.
Maybe a tad. And then I was having a conversation with someone on our Discord server, and he happens to be in Louisiana. He was just about to head offshore, and he gave me a link to an article that'll be in the show notes. But this is what he said. He said, just a reminder that in Louisiana, it's practically a crime to be registered and poor. Community notification is paid for by the registrant. Mine just cost me $193 for a newspaper ad and $500 for postcards, plus $82 for an ID card and a driver's license, good for just 1 year. Can't pay? That's a felony failure to notify, minimum 2 years, up to 10. That's insane, Larry. Those are like annual fees that you have to pay of, you know, whatever, like $1,000 almost.
Well, no, the part of them are not annual fees. It's the notices when you move into the dwelling. So theoretically, here's where I mean, and I'm not for it. I'm against it, and I'll tell a story about what we're trying to do about it with NARSL. But it's a fee that's assessed for community notification when you move into the community. And now, if you do basic math and you look at an urban area, it's within a zone, and I forget the radius of your residence, that everyone has to be notified. So if you live out in the boonies, there would be fewer notification flyers required. If you live in New Orleans, you've got to have a whole lot more dense population. So everybody has to be notified. And there's not an instantaneous incarceration for not paying that money. The notices still go out, to my understanding. But then if the person doesn't pay within some period of time, then it is a violation. Now, I may have that wrong because I was working with, you know, our friend King Alexander from Calcasieu Parish. He said Calcasieu Parish in Louisiana. He's a supervising felony without life a parole attorney. He described it to me, and I did not actually look at the statute with great detail. But then if the notices are being withheld until the person pays, then that's a whole different can of worms. But I thought I understood that the notices still go out, but that the person has to pay for them.
Okay.
Nonetheless,
he is in a pretty populated area. I know like exactly where he lives. I used to live in New Orleans, and I know exactly where he lives. It's a pretty densely populated area on the West Bank of New Orleans.
So nonetheless, it is probably unconstitutional. But what have we said for the last 100 episodes on this podcast about things?
They can do it until they're told to stop.
And who tells them to stop?
We have to litigate somehow or tell the legislators to stop. I think those are only two avenues. We have to sue them and make the legislation change.
Either the courts say it's not enforceable or it has to be changed by legislative action.
Yep. And Paul Dubling said litigate, legislate, and I guess he had educate in there in his
educate,
Houston.
Well, of course that's we've had that for a decade or more before he came along.
Okay.
That's the three prongs of what we're trying to do. But here's the problem. We were actually in negotiations with a law firm in Louisiana, a private attorney, to litigate this very issue. And we were very close, I thought, to having an agreement with them until they turned renegade. And I won't name any names, so they won't be able to say that anybody was being libelous. But we were very close to coming to an agreement about litigating that very thing, claim that this is a debtor's prison, so to speak.
Right.
And there's U.S. Supreme Court precedent out of Georgia that would be a Bearden claim. We were close, but they decided that in exchange for our money, that we could have no say-so about the case. We would not be involved in the strategy. They did not want to reimburse us if they would prevail. I mean, there were everything that we expected in an agreement with a law firm, they objected to. And I said, well, let me just make sure I have this straight. What you want is for us just simply to be money bags. We would be able to give you money. We have nothing to say about the strategy. We get nothing no input in the settlement, if there is one, and it's entirely under your command, and we just simply pay the bill, and they wanted it to be an unlimited bill where we usually put a cap on the legal fees because legal fees can run in excess of six figures. So you want us to agree to just constantly pay you regardless of how long this litigation stretches. I said, we would have a line of attorneys from here to Baton Rouge if we could agree to that. And I said, of course, we would have people lined up from coast to coast that would be willing to do litigation under that arrangement. So we didn't come to an agreement. And then they went ahead and filed it without us. They went ahead and filed a civil rights complaint. And they got bogged down in federal court because of the doctrine of not exhausting. So the exhaustion of other remedies. And since the court didn't want to deal with it. Last I heard about the case is held in abeyance until some state remedies were exhausted. And since we were not funding the litigation, I haven't followed it. But it's a viable, bona fide complaint. It should be litigated. It probably is unconstitutional, but they're going to keep doing it until they're stopped.
Very good. Wow. And when did that occur? When was that going on?
A couple years back.
Gotcha. All right.
So this is not new. This is stuff that's been going in Louisiana for a long time. Louisiana is one of the that whole Bible Belt of southern states of forgiveness. It's one of the places where things are really harsh. Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi.
Okay, I wasn't going to bring this up, but did you hear who's running for his old position in Alabama?
Well, that would be former Senator Jeff Sessions, former Attorney General,
and I can't
U.S. Attorney General.
And is he like pro? Like criminal justice reform, is he pro like the legalization or at least the reduction of the criminal sentences behind marijuana and other drug things? Is he that kind of a candidate?
Absolutely not. He was the one who was Attorney General who gave out the orders to seek maximum penalties for everything. I mean, that he's absolutely not for that.
He does sound like Ross Perot, don't you think?
There is a similarity, but yes, he's a hard-nosed law and order guy.
All right, let's start going into this stuff, man, before we get too far derailed. This first article comes from law.com. I guess it's the Connecticut Law Tribune. I guess that's like a sub-publication there. Second Circuit overturns conviction of man who traveled across state lines for sex with a teen. It seemed to me in reading this, Larry, that it was like everyone was lying about their age. The victim was lying about her age. The young man was lying about his age. And so... Did I read it right that the defense side is saying, well, everybody lied, so if it was okay for her to lie about her age, shouldn't it be okay for my client to lie about his age?
There was nothing in the case that revolved around. He wasn't prosecuted for lying.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, it was apparent, and that wasn't a defense that was asserted that he lied. This case is actually relatively complex, and it involves a lot of good juicy stuff. So what happened was the government, this was a federal charge. He traveled from Rhode Island to Connecticut, do I have it backwards?
That sounds right. So he traveled up there in New England back and forth, which would be a stone's throw based on how big those states are.
So he went to have sex, and he did have sex, and he was charged with traveling in interstate commerce for the purpose of knowingly engaging in a sexual act with a minor not younger than 12 and not yet at least 16 and at least 4 years his junior.
Right.
He pled guilty. He traveled from Rhode Island to Connecticut for the purpose of having sexual intercourse with a young girl he told detectives he believed to be 16 years old, when she was in fact younger. Well, the problem was the government... They had a statute that fit what he did, but they didn't use it because it did not give him enough prison sentence. They didn't. So they could have used Section 2423A, but they wanted 2423B. And 2423B, the criminality is the travel with the intent of having sex with someone over 12 and less than 16. He did not have any intent whatsoever of having sex with anyone between 12 and 16.
Right.
He initially answered an ad that said that the person was older, that they were 19. And then they magically became 16. But 16 is above the age where that statute covers. And the crime of that he was being charged with was not for having the sex. It was for traveling across state lines with the intent of having sex with a person who was under 16, but yet over 12. He had no such intent whatsoever.
So there, and also since he lied about his age, then the age difference was only a 3-year difference based on both of their lies.
So, that wasn't that so much matter. A factor. The factor here was the government tried to have it both ways because they wanted the more serious criminal penalty, and they tried to pretend this was a strict liability offense, but it's not, because there's an affirmative defense in there that his state of mind if he reasonably believes the person is over 16, then this subsection doesn't apply. 2423B doesn't apply. And they would have had a slam dunk if they'd used 2423A, but it didn't give enough time. So, Mr. Prosecutor, when you want too much, you end up with nothing. But a lot of things went wrong with this case other than that. Other than that, the attorney did not know, had not done, his defense attorney had not done his homework, and he didn't understand the statute required that the person be traveling with the intent of having sex with a person under 16. He didn't know that. He thought just merely the fact that they had sex with someone. The girl turned out to be 14.
Yeah.
But that was not relevant for this analysis because that wasn't his intent. The crime was the traveling, not the sex. When he crossed into Connecticut, his state of mind when he crossed that boundary of what he was intending to do was what mattered, not what he actually did. The crime would have been complete if he had never had sex, because the crime was the interstate travel with the intent to have sex with a person over 12 and less than 16. He had no such intent.
Could you back up and remind us what strict liability is?
Strict liability is when a person is criminally responsible without any requisite intent required, just something that you did. So that's quite common with we're going to talk about that in a couple of minutes, about the Connecticut statute itself that he actually was prosecuted under. And that makes this case fascinating because people don't understand that each sovereign has jurisdiction. He was prosecuted in Connecticut for actually having the sex, and he's a convicted sex offender in Connecticut because he had the sex. But this crime was the interstate travel, and there was no requisite knowledge. His state of mind was that he intended to have sex with a 16-year-old. And that was not enough under this particular statute for the feds to have their jurisdiction. So his conviction was set aside. And not only was it funny about that, it was so funny that the prosecutor got it wrong, the defense attorney got it wrong, and the judge got it wrong. The judge didn't do the proper admonishments to let him know what the burden of proof was. They just kind of glossed over the fact that the government would have had to prove him that he was intending to have sex with someone under 16. They just glossed over it and said, well, that he intended to have sex. Well, he did intend to have sex, but not with someone within that specifically prohibited category. He was very much intending on having sex, but crossing a state line to have sex is not against the law. People do that all the time. So if you're crossing the state line to have sex with someone who is permissible to have sex with, that's not so. The mere act of crossing the state line did not bring him within a zone of prosecution. So it's a fascinating read for those people who enjoy these nuances of the law. I've highlighted this probably the most highlights I've ever put in a case because this is so fascinating.
Did you actually highlight, like with a highlighter on the PDF?
Yes, I always do that. but not with a highlighter, but I actually use the...
Sorry, I couldn't resist that one, Larry.
But he got prosecuted under state law. Now, let's take a look at the state law. It's called sexual assault. Now, in Connecticut, sexual assault in the second degree is a Class C or B felony. A person is guilty of sexual assault in the second degree when such person engages in sexual intercourse with another person and, one, such person is 13 years of age or older, but under 16, which that's what this person was, and the actress more than 3 years older than such other person. So he would have been convicted. His plea would have been to 53A-71A subsection 1. And this is a strict liability offense. Such there was no knowledge required that a person is guilty of sexual assault in second degree when such person engages in sexual intercourse with another person, and such other person is 13 years of age or older but under 16. So I'm taking that's probably the age of consent in Connecticut, and the actor is more than 3 years older than such other person. So he had a strict liability in Connecticut because he did the dirty deed. And there was no requirement that he know anything here. Now, he did know that she was 16, according to her representation.
Right.
But once they linked up, then he had an opportunity to do an additional evaluation. And the theory goes, and I don't agree with this theory, but the theory goes, once you've examined the merchandise, you have additional information to make a decision. When he got to Connecticut, even though she was saying she was 16, he could have said, I'm having a little dubiosity about this. you don't really look.
Right.
You don't really look 16. So I don't think we can go through with this. That is an option he has available. Or he can say, can I see your school ID? Because most people 16 are still in school, even though I think that's where compulsory attendance drops out in most states is age 16. But you could take some liberties to figure out by asking a few questions, but that just doesn't run through the average person's head when they're in that state of mind. Who can you think of that's done that in your life that said, well, let me see your ID?
I don't think very many people go do that.
Well, this is a strict liability offense. So in my view, Connecticut sexual assault statute is probably unconstitutional.
Interesting. Yeah, this has a whole bunch of nooks and crannies and twists and turns of the various different angles to look at this from.
Well, the great thing about it is that so many of the circuits have said the same thing about this particular crime. Now, you would think that U.S. attorneys' offices around the country would have realized by now when there's all the sister circuits have said that this requires that you be able to prove that the person intended, because that's what the statute says. You're intending to have sex with someone between 12 and 16. Now, if you are one who believes in black letter law, that's pretty straightforward. and then of course the government would quickly flip if the situation were reversed. If it was an imposter, if it was an officer pretending to be under 16, then they would say, well, it's all right to pretend, but the reality is that even though that she's a 27 or 34 or 49 or whatever age, they would say, never mind what she actually is. See, they argued in his case that he should be held liable because her actual age was 14. But they would do a magic flip-flop if it was one of their detectives posing as a minor, and if you used that as a defense, you said, well, you know, he actually showed up and the person was 42 years old. That didn't matter. So the court called them out on that duplicity in the 37-page opinion. They said it would have been amazing to watch what you would have argued the other way. So
okay, so good, there's that.
And good stuff.
Yeah, and you've highlighted
good stuff.
The legal doc will be in the show notes for those of you that want to read it.
So there's plenty of the yellow in this one.
Let's move over to Courthouse News. I think we have a couple other. Yeah, we have two other articles from Courthouse News. This is ex-NFL player Kellen Winslow Jr. pleads guilty to rape. And I am very confused. This looks pretty straightforward. And I'm curious as to why you have thrown this into the show this week.
Just for... as far as I'm concerned, this is an example of I'm sure they tried extra hard because of his status being a former NFL player. There's something really charming about bringing down a person that has standing in the community or has had standing in the community. And they tried him and the jury deadlocked, so they got a second bite at the apple with a deadlocked jury. And each time a person goes to trial, the second and third time, if it's allowed, the case gets better for the state and worse for the defense, because each time the state learns what they didn't do. So he apparently, Winslow played for Cleveland, Tampa Bay, New England, New York Jets, and earned more than $40 million in 10 seasons. And I'm sure that he's spent a significant amount of that money in this. And I'm not justifying if he was guilty and pled guilty, because he actually was guilty. But I don't like that when they keep trying a person second, third, and fourth time, it's like, hey, you're eventually going to get it right.
Just like Galen.
You're going to eventually get what you're looking for. So when I see a second, third trial, I just have a dubiosity about how fair the second and in particular the third trial, but this was the second trial.
Yeah. So why doesn't that start crossing the line of anything of double jeopardy?
I wish I could explain that, but since I can't explain it, I don't know. The fact that you've been in trial, you face the consequences, but since the trial's incomplete by not a verdict, they deem that that's not, the jeopardy hasn't truly attached. But I have,
interesting. I mean,
decision is rendered at a hung jury. It's just there. We can't come to an agreement.
But that almost speaks to that neither side could push it far enough. So aren't you innocent until proven guilty? Then, since they couldn't push it far enough to get you to be convicted, that they should then just go home?
Well, that's an argument that I'd like to have made, but when the jury is unable to reach a determination, then there's no jeopardy as far as the system's concerned, because you never had a decision made. You were not determined to be not guilty. You weren't determined to be guilty. There was a de facto. Mistrials don't just happen because of hung jury. They happen because of people making comments they shouldn't make in front of a jury. You can have a mistrial where an admonishment won't be sufficient to cure the contamination. Jurors can do things that they're not allowed to do, and a juror can be dismissed, or a second juror dismissed. If you don't have enough alternates, you end up with not having a full. I mean, there's a number of things that can cause a mistrial, but this thing with the hung jury, that they got a second bite of the apple and he decided to cop a plea. Maybe he is guilty. But it seems like a pretty harsh outcome. And so I guess things are getting pretty tough out there. Was it in California?
I
think it's in California. Yeah, California.
Vista, California. Okay, then. Hey, well, we go with another vigilante justice warning. This is WTHR. This is Logansport, Indiana. Police warn against vigilante justice. You got some schmo out there who's created an Instagram account, and he has then also created a fake teen profile, whatever. And he's out there trolling to get alleged child predators to come visit him. I guess those wouldn't even be alleged. He is getting people to come in and visit him at a rendezvous point. And he is filming it and then turning over the evidence to the police. And the police aren't really interested. This is a dangerous thing to do. But he's gotten 47,000 followers in 4 days.
Well, maybe we should emulate what he's doing.
Why would we do that?
Well, I'm talking about in terms of getting the followers. Maybe we should figure out what he does to get 47 followers in 4 days.
Yes, we could do that. I have a feeling that my handlers would frown upon me doing that.
Well, I'm not saying we should do that, but whatever magic he's done, I mean, he had to start it from scratch, right? He had himself as a follower when he launched his endeavor, right?
Yes.
Okay, whatever he did to get to 47,000 in 4 days, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about replicating his activity, but whatever magic he had that extended his visibility to 48,000 people, that's what I'd like to replicate. There should be 48,000 people listening to this podcast.
There should be, but because so in his case, I mean, the answer to that is he has done something super controversial, but just that people want to then amplify and share and share and share. And then it just goes viral, so to speak. And I'm speaking to the people in chat. You're not doing that. So that's why we're not viral.
Is that the reason?
Yes. The you.
Okay.
People.
So let's digress a little bit more. Okay. So he started with just himself. What did he do that allowed himself to explode to 48,000? Did he get himself on the news? What did he do that's different than what we've been doing for the last 101 episodes?
I think, simply put, just like watching a video of someone doing whatever and they wreck themselves, you know, like a fail video. And he has created this video where he has then entrapped somebody, however you want to word it, where he's gotten someone to come out to a location trying to have sex with someone underage, whatever. Films it, and then he shares it with his 1,000 original friends. And then it just explodes, and then they share it amongst their friends and so on. It's just like that commercial back in the 70s, and they'll tell two friends and so on and so on. And the screen fills up little squares. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that commercial?
Yes. So
you're drawing a blank on the commercial.
Well, that you people out there listening need to do that to grow this podcast.
That's what I've been saying the whole time. Please share it. But yeah, anyway. So yeah, they don't do that. But that's the same thing with Narsal. How many of the, it kind of does fall on deaf ears, Larry, that we know that so many of our people, when they find out about it, they just go, yeah, I'm just going to keep my head below the firing line. And there's not really much exposure for someone to share this video because, you know, people that are trying to have sex with underage people are generally hated, and there's no social cost for them to do it and share it to their next, the next circle of friends that they have. But there mm-hmm. is to some degree a social cost of having the people that you know in your circle that aren't one of our people to share this project that we're doing with their friends.
I see what you're saying, that there's not the appeal, the broad appeal that there is to protecting people from child predators.
Yes, that is correct. So yeah, so there's another vigilante out there, and this is, I don't know, we've covered this sort of subject a half dozen times in our 100 episode history. 100 episodes, how about that? That sounds kind of cool, right?
Yeah, and I put it in here just for that reason, that these people don't stop. They feed upon themselves. And we've talked about it in Washington, Oregon, up in the Northwest Corridor, and I forgot all the different states where we've mentioned this. Now this is in the heartland of Indiana. So it's not going to stop. Until these people are stopped by some forces greater than them, they're not going to stop doing this because it works. It gets them notoriety, viewers, followers.
And they're potentially breaking the law at the same time. And, you know, so you could misidentify someone. You could harm them for someone that has not done anything wrong necessarily. My one other question to you is, I'm sure the answer is not a no, but does this happen in any other kinds of crimes of any sort? I'm sure someone is out there doing vigilante something, but I don't think that I've really ever heard of any sort of vigilante justice going around.
Well, I'm drawing a blank, but it could be. But it seems like that in this area of where the vigilante is, everybody's mad if you've got a sister. Well, I've got a sister. I'll kill your ass for. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Well, let's see. She's 16, and he was 19, and that. Well, you don't mess with my sister, man.
Correct. Correct. They're just kids, man. You can't be messing with the kids. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. And this is a Wall Street Journal article that says most plea bargains are unconstitutional. I am very much inclined to agree with the sentiment that, you know, we don't cover all 27 amendments on any regular basis, but we do cover a handful of them, and they're kind of sort of a non-negotiable thing. With the First Amendment, there's only the negotiation of you can't use certain kinds of words in public places, saying that there's an explosive device somewhere. I'm not going to say the B word. So you have a pretty unrestricted freedom of speech that the government can't shut down. But when you move off to this kind of stuff where you have the right to a trial by jury and all that stuff, I'm inclined to kind of agree with the way that this article is presenting things, that this does feel sort of like a constitutional violation.
It always has to me as well. And for those of you who decide to read the article, it's by Alan Dershowitz, who's a professor at Harvard Law School. And he's well recognized as being an expert on the Constitution. And sometimes he irritates people because he's questioned some of the things that's going on in the Trump impeachment. But Professor Dershowitz and I agree on this, to penalize a person for invoking a right just doesn't seem to be, that just doesn't seem to be the spirit of what the founding fathers would have intended. So you have the right to be free of unreasonable search and seizure. So you require that the police obtain a warrant. That would be, to me, equivalent to the police coming and breaking your house down once they have the warrant as a penalty for you requiring them to do what the Constitution requires. Since you have the right and the presumption of innocence, and you have the right to go to trial, it would seem like that to extract an additional penalty for invoking that right would be unconstitutional. Now that's the world the way it should be. The world the way it is being in America is that you will get a substantially greater sentence if you go to trial. And the Supreme Court has said that's okay. In fact, I think they even referenced the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in 1970 where they said that, but the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the system depends on plea bargains, and that's just the way things are done. When you hear me pontificate, I pontificate it simply because if you just read this article about what happens to people that don't, when they're getting 10 times, they cite cases in this article where people received 10 times as much of a sentence that had they taken the plea offer. And so I'm just here to tell you, if you're offered a great plea, even though you're not guilty, it may be in your best interest to take that plea, because the question is going to be, can they convict you? Not whether you're guilty or not. Sorry, the question is whether or not they can convict you. And if they can convict you, they're likely going to receive a much harsher sentence than what the plea bargain would offer. Now, there's all the criticism people make. Well, Larry, if everybody would refuse to plead, the whole system would crash. It absolutely would crash if everyone refused to plead. But the only problem is everyone is not going to refuse to plead because it's in their interest to do so. If you're facing for something where you actually did do it, and you could be sentenced to 18 years, and they're offering you a probated sentence, it's certainly in your interest to plead guilty. And your defense attorney has a solemn duty to tell you, hey, the evidence is overwhelming, and they're offering you a sweetheart deal. Because in my experience with the evidence they have, they're going to secure a conviction on at least two of these three charges. And with these two charges that they're going to probably convict you on, you're facing up to 11 years in prison. And they're offering you a guarantee of probation. So that person is not going to refuse to plead so that they can bring the system down. They're just not going to do that. So the reality is, you can have the fantasy about bringing the system down. It's not going to happen. That's not the way we're going to crash the system, is by people refusing to plead. They're not going to do that.
Well, if they did flip this over and make it so that effectively everything went to jury trial, they would have to expand the capacity of the system. But at the same time, they would have to turn around and reduce the number of things that are getting prosecuted, kind of going under the guise of like the Larry Krasner model of these minor things shouldn't get prosecuted.
Well, is it really in the interest of justice that everything go to jury trial? People who absolutely did do what was charged, and there is no doubt that they prosecutors overcharged, but say that they straight charged it correctly, that all the elements, they didn't reach for extra counts, and they didn't overcharge like the case we talked about just a short while ago. Why should that person go to trial if they've charged them correctly, and if they're offering an outcome that's in the interest of justice? What's the justification for going to trial? Well, if they offer you a probated sentence and it's your first time offense, and they're offering you an opportunity for rehabilitation, what would you gain by going to trial when they're just going to convict you? What would be the benefit of that?
Well, I mean, if you are innocent, and the stigma and the baggage that comes along with having a conviction is pretty steep, and if you are innocent, why would you take the plea?
Well, but that's not what the question I posed. You said if everybody went to trial, we would have to assume that at least a fraction of the people that police charge are guilty of something, right?
That is true.
Okay, so I'm going to assume that probably at least 50% plus one of the people that police charge are guilty, and it's probably a lot higher than that.
I would agree with that, too.
So I'm posing the question, why should there be a trial on everything if they haven't overcharged you, over-indicted you, and if they're offering you an outcome that is rehabilitative, and what would be the benefit to you? The best you could hope for to go to trial, if the evidence is overwhelming against you, would be that what they offered you, the judge might do that. So what would be the reason to go to trial if you know you're guilty and they have not overcharged you? Why would you do that?
I don't have an answer for that then. It would make the judicial system more expedient and efficient in doing that way.
To have more trials, it would make
no,
it
no,
more
no,
expedient.
No, to be able to take a plea, I mean, is what I'm saying.
So, well, and if everybody did do that, which they're not going to, but if everybody did do that, you are correct. The capacity would have to be dramatically expanded, or the put-through would have to be dramatically reduced, or a combination of the two, because yes, if every single case was going to go to trial, but every single case is never going to go to trial, every single case has never gone to trial. Even in the best of times, all the cases didn't go to trial.
You know, this almost sounds like balancing the budget, Larry. We have to increase revenue and reduce spending.
What a concept.
Shall we move on?
We're doing the increase of revenue. That's a natural that happens in the U.S. The revenues go up regardless of who's president. The only problem is that in this administration, spending is going up four times the rate of revenue. That's the only problem with this one. But go ahead with the next question.
I just want to know, are you ready to move on to the next article before we go down that down that rabbit trail?
Sure.
All right. So we're going to move over to the Washington Post. And these prosecutors won office vowing to fight the system. Now the system is fighting back. I don't know exactly. We covered when Larry Krasner started making these changes to prosecute fewer crimes and all these things, that the legislature that came right behind him said, nope, you can't do that. I don't know what the results of those things are. But this is a prosecutor in Boston. We should get Richard on the podcast to speak some of these terms so that we can have the right accent. And trying to do something similar of prosecuting less crimes or... Isn't jaywalking illegal, Larry?
Well, it generally is, yes.
Okay, but I don't know that I've ever seen anyone or heard of anyone being prosecuted. Perhaps in New York City where like you have to have very regulated traffic controls so the cars and the people can move about. But... why don't those get prosecuted? I realize it's a misdemeanor and probably kind of an extreme example, but nobody prosecutes that crime. So isn't it at the discretion of the DA of what they prosecute anyway?
Well, it is. But the part that you're missing that everybody misses is that you're talking about people's livelihoods here. And I have yet to find people who want to cut themselves out of existence. And can you think of an occupation where they say, gee, I can't wait till we downsize to the point that I'm not needed anymore? When I have conversations at the Kroger store next door, they don't say that. When I have conversations with the bus drivers that operate the city transit, they don't say that. When I have conversations with the garbage truck operators, they don't say that. Prison operators, judges, prosecutors, all these people depend on the system the way it is now. And if you change the way the system is now markedly and you have fewer people being prosecuted, that sets off a whole chain reaction of fewer people needed down the line. That means the officers don't get overtime to be in court, to show up for docket calls where the case is to continue and they get to come back several times. That means that pre-sentence report writers don't get to write pre-sentence reports. So we don't need as many people in the probation department because we don't have as many people in the system to supervise. It means fewer people being sent to prison. It means a cascading effect on loss of jobs. And you think these people are just going to magically say, of course I would like to see fewer people employed in my profession. The counselors that provide, I mean, it's nonsensical to think that people are going to willingly want to see this apparatus downsize.
Isn't it NARSOL's objective to work our way out of being an organization?
That is. It absolutely is. Now, we'll never be able to do that.
I know that. Because
there will never be an end to unconstitutionality of stuff that people propose and get enacted into law. But ideally, we would very much like to have no longer be a need for us because we're all volunteers and we'd like to cease volunteering. But in terms of people whose livelihoods are at stake, the listeners, feel free to shoot me emails on people who are trying their best to get themselves out of existence. I don't think the cross-country truck drivers are trying to end their jobs. I just can't think of any. When the railroad industry downsized and they quit having caboose people at the front of the train and the caboose, I don't think they were saying, gee, we don't need this job anymore. The elevator, I mean, on and on. Who wants to eliminate their job?
So your email address is oldcurmudgeon@gmail.com. Is that right?
that's correct. But
so just kidding.
But my point is there shouldn't be any surprise that there's the pushback because you're talking about upsetting the status quo. And you're talking about people whose livelihoods depend on this, seeing that they're being impacted adversely. Of course, they're going to push back.
You can't tell
me
they're
going to use scare tactics.
Hang on, stop. Somebody that just has their paycheck come in versus destroying somebody's life. That I don't even know how those two things would actually end up being compared together.
They don't see themselves as destroying people's lives. You can't find people who work in the system who think that they're doing bad things.
That's disturbing on its own.
Well, start asking them. Start with your PO. Ask them, do you think that you're doing bad things? And go around and ask the cops. When you run into a beat cop, say, do you think you're doing good or bad?
I do know that from talking to my own handler about this, that individual says that their caseload is too high and it's a waste of time to monitor the number of people that they monitor, and that they should be able to focus their energy on the individuals that they believe to be a higher threat.
Okay, well, but ask that same handler, if they were to do a dramatic reduction and include elimination of your handler's job, ask her how that would go over.
Yeah, it might not go over.
If
so
we
well.
Reduce it, yeah, well, that's what you're talking about. When you're dramatically altering the status quo, you're talking about an impact on people's livelihoods.
Yeah.
And people who do this work for a living, I don't care whether they work in prisons, they don't see themselves. Now, they may internally know that they do bad things, but when they go sing in the choir on Sunday morning, they tell people, I'm keeping you safe from the bad guys. I go to this horrible prison and I work with these vermin, and I try to keep them from coming out to do bad things to you. That's what they would say. They would not go in and say that I do everything I can to make my life miserable, that I jingle the keys as loud as I can, and I slam the doors as hard as I can, and I turn on the lights in the middle of the night. They're not going to tell that when they're talking about what the job they do. They're not going to say that I'm an evil person. When's the last time you've heard someone say that?
I guess I really haven't heard many people say that one.
Yeah, I put their medicine in water and let it explode before I give them their medication. I mean, I used to know of jail guards who did that. They thought it took great satisfaction out of reading people's mail, dropping it in the floor because mm-hmm. they thought it had some perfume on it, and they didn't want to make sure that the perfume was on the floor when the inmate was sniffing the letter, because it was reminding him that his loved one had put the nice scent of fresh. I mean, I've.
Yep.
You probably know far more about what goes on behind those walls than I do, but I know enough to know that there's some questionable people working, but they don't see themselves that way.
You did a puny amount of time, didn't you?
A puny amount, yeah, like 6 months.
We'll come back to that later.
You could do 6 months standing on your head.
I completely agree with that sentiment. I completely agree with that. But there's one little thing in here. So this prosecutor says Rollins, that's the woman's name. What is her first name? Rachel Rollins, that's her name. So Miss Rollins, who was raised in Cambridge, developed her views about the justice system in part through her experience as a federal prosecutor in Boston. The system also touched her personal life. Two of her siblings are incarcerated, she said, and a third is in recovery for opioid addiction. In addition to her own teenage daughter, she said Rollins is the guardian for two nieces because of her siblings' circumstances. That was the point I wanted to highlight, was that she is the caretaker of the niece, two of the kids from her brothers that are in prison. That's the destruction of lives that I'm referring to. Yes, they probably committed crimes. I'm not questioning that. Or maybe they committed crimes, but it's just the collateral damage on the other side of all this stuff going down is just horrific to me.
Well, that's a conversation that I wish we were having in this country, because as the demographics continue to be more unfavorable to us, we're headed toward the European model of zero population growth and possibly negative population growth, depending on how much we clamp down on our borders and on immigration. But when we saddle people with a felony, in particular sex felonies, but felonies in general with criminal records, we reduce their earning potential. And we need to have a conversation about that. When we're doing that, we're relegating these people to second class status, and we're hurting our own selves, because that $1 trillion budget deficit we just finished at the federal level on the year that ended September 30th of what is that, about a month ago?
Yeah.
That number is going to continue to grow because we need these people working and earning maximum pay so that they can, if we don't want any new arrivals and we don't have a birth rate internally, if we don't do that and we're at negative population growth, our demographics are just like Japan's and just like some of the European countries that are facing this. And we need to have that conversation about, hey, we need these folks earning at their maximum potential. We need to remove as many barriers as we can so that they can earn maximum money, because we've got our paws out wanting to collect what we think that we've paid into, and actually what we've paid into has supported the previous generation. And I don't know, you've had that conversation with a guy that you worked with through the years. He says, well, I paid into that. And I said, well, unfortunately, you paid into it for the previous generation. That's not your money.
I think you left out immigration too out of that we have, you know, we've clamped that down pretty tight too.
Well, that's all I did say that we clamped down on immigration. Depends on how much more we clamp down on immigration. But immigration has been our salvation in terms of keeping our country in a growth population growth status. Without immigration, we've already flatlined and probably negative as far as internal. And that's not a favorable trend for a nation to have an aging population. And not a significant generation following them to support them. And we need to make sure that we're conscious of that, and criminal records diminish. I mean, if it was just two people that had a criminal record, but we have, a significant number of Americans with criminal records.
It's a pretty big chunk.
That are, I think it's something approaching 20%.
I believe. I was going to say it's as high as a third, I thought. Yeah, that at least so, like somehow, yes, they've touched the criminal justice system in some form or fashion.
And that's significant degradation in their earnings potential with those records. And we're going to have that conversation. And one of our articles that's going to come up here shortly about Michigan, they're actually having that conversation.
Yes. Let's move over to courthouse news again. Judge wants to know which Texas prison official lied. I just want to bring up one thing about this article. This has to do with making a certain number of prisons in Texas have air conditioning, so because there are people that are very sensitive to the heat. And I mean, like Texas, that's not really that hot of a state. But the thing
no, it's just 110 degrees. Just 110 degrees.
Man, come on! If you can't handle 110, you're not even trying. But the thing that I wanted to point out is at the very end of the article, it says there's no plan to track the temperature at the non-AC prisons. Holy crap, man! So they're trying to keep the prisons that are air conditioned 88 degrees. Which is still pretty hot, but you know, I guess it's tolerable because there's not going to be any humidity. But can you imagine then at the other prisons, they're not even going to keep track of how hot it is? That's insanity, Larry.
Well, but see, that appeals to Texans. If you were to go out and poll the average Texan, I'm not talking about 100%, but if you take a poll across a broad section of Texans and you ask, do you think that we should air condition the prisons, and you stop at the end of that question, the average person would say no.
Right.
It's not a country club. And by golly, when I was coming along, when I was young, we didn't even have air conditioning when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and I somehow got through it. And these people who are breaking the law, and they want us, we're already feeding them and clothing them, and we're already doing all this for them, costing us money. And all you want to do is just spend more money so that we have to pay taxes to take care of these freeloaders. I think we're paying enough already. That would be the average reaction from the average Texan. And until that reaction is different, the officials in Texas are going to reflect that will of the people, because that is what they're supposed to be reflecting, is the will of the people. That's what we do in a representative republic. And when the people start calling saying, I can't believe you're taking that position because it doesn't represent me. I believe that we would not treat a dog this way. And I believe that the health ramifications from overheating are so significant that we want our prisons to be at least moderately ventilated. I think that you would see the Texas prison officials magically change their position. And you'd see the elected officials who make policy for Texas, you'd see them magically change their position. They're merely representing what the people want.
The one other thing that I would bring up is to hearken back to what you just said earlier about your one prison in your state, that Texas has more than 100 prisons.
Well, now, I said that at that time in 1980. We have a lot of prisons now, but we don't have 100, thankfully. Oh,
good grief. And also, I mean, obviously, Texas has a greater population than New Mexico, but still. Man, 100 prisons?
Well, Texas incarcerates at a higher rate than we do.
Oh,
but
why is that?
Well, again, it reflects the will of the average Texas person. Texans and across the South, the Bible forgiving belt, they are very, very harsh on, they believe, by God, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And
he did that crime and he needs to pay for it, and he needs to pay for it so he don't forget about it anytime soon. That's the attitude in Texas and Alabama and Louisiana, where they have these high rates of incarceration comparatively. Now, even states in this country who have low rates of incarceration, we're still above all of the rest of the Western world.
Yes.
We're still incarcerate. Even the progressive states that incarcerate at a far lower rate, we still outdo the rest of the world in terms of the way that they measure based on population. But the South is particularly harsh with how many people they incarcerate.
It's very sad. So those people are going to get roasted. And Ryan points out in chat, he's just saying that if you keep it cool around 60 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, there'll be less violence. Too hot actually causes the amygdala activation. That's almost like the
medulla.
The amygdala.
How do you spell that?
A-M-I-G-D-A-L-A. And that's totally true. That's just another one of like the...
A-M-I-G.
D-A-L-A. Keep going. D-A-L-A.
All right. I've never heard that before.
Oh, man. Another word. So this is another one of these like, you know, central processing things of your brain that when you're hot, angry and cranky.
So we've got people that know a whole lot more about brains than I do.
Yes, but you know a whole lot more about the law and how to do policy and stuff like that. So you got us beat on that front.
So the Abendula Gala and the amygdala or whatever this is.
That would be amygdala. There, try that. Can you say amygdala?
Amygdala.
Yeah, there you go.
What was the other one? The Abendula Gala?
The medulla oblongata.
The medulla oblongata. Okay, you say so.
All right. Another article from Courthouse News is Eighth Circuit strikes down Arkansas's anti-panhandling law. This has nothing to do with registry stuff, Larry. Why did you throw this garbage in here?
It doesn't have much to do with it, but it does tangentially, and that's why I put it in here. Because what we have is the Eighth Circuit, which is up the center of the United States, Missouri, Arkansas, Nebraska. I forgot how far it goes, how many states are in the Eighth Circuit. What we have is a circuit court expressing great dubiosity about restrictions on speech by the government, because Arkansas has this panhandling law that they are insisting on trying. You got two ways to deal with panhandling and homelessness. You can lock them up like they used to do and pretend you don't have a problem. Or you can actually spend money on trying to deal with homelessness. So they try to criminalize poverty, and that's what they've done. And these two took this up, that they took up the challenge to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. And what it's telling me is that this circuit seems to be pretty adamant about intrusion by the government in the area of speech. And even those who we don't think a lot of, homeless people, are pretty much despised and scoffed at, and people spit at them and throw things at them and tell them to get a job and loser and all that kind of stuff. But the courts are saying, we're going to protect your rights. So the reason I put it in there is that I think Missouri has a Halloween ban where that people can't express themselves. And I think that this would connect nicely to government suppression on expression, because as the Eighth Circuit pointed out, and I didn't put the highlights in this one like I did in the other one, but as the Eighth Circuit pointed out, that when you do a content-based restriction, which is what they did in this statute, they restricted the content, and that's what they're doing in Halloween when they're restricting. You can't put a decoration. They describe all the things you cannot do on Halloween. You can't have decorations. You can't wear costumes. You can't put on makeup and all these things. What they're doing, that's a content-based restriction, which those have to be narrowly tailored. And as far as I know, the states that are doing that, they're not narrowly tailoring those, because you might could withstand judicial scrutiny with a narrowly tailored Halloween restriction that was only applied to certain people. So this gives me hope that we can look at that part of the country as a possible new front in the war on Halloween restrictions. And so that's why I put it in there.
I like it. I like when you pull out the tangentially related ones. That's why we pay you the big bucks.
So that's what I see in this case, is we've got an Eighth Circuit telling us. So if I were licensed to practice law and in Missouri, I would take a very good look at that Eighth Circuit decision. I'd take a very good look at the Halloween restrictions in Missouri. And I would contact the state officials and say, I don't think you need to be enforcing this any longer, because if you do, I'm going to sue you. And of course, they would say, go ahead. And then I would say, okay, and we're going to make a bunch of money off of you. That's what I think I would do. But since I'm not licensed to practice law, I can't do that. But it encourages me to look around for people who might have the capacity to do that, because I think there might be a nugget here.
And this next article comes from the fake news headquarters of CNN. I'm really just kidding. I'm just trying to troll some folks out there that probably do think that CNN is fake news. Before his execution, a death row inmate told his victim's family he forgives them. Did you put this in there because of his particular sexual orientation?
No, I just thought that that it was just kind of cute that usually it's the other way around. And he forgives the family for being mad at him. I just thought it was kind of an ironic twist.
Oh, I thought because he seems to have been convicted because the jury found out of his gay stance. And this was the 90s before it would have really gained a lot of acceptance in our society. He was convicted at 22 in 1992. I'm sorry. He stabbed a 22-year-old. I don't know how old he was in 1992. But back then, there was significantly less acceptance of people of that persuasion. So I wasn't sure if that was why you put it in here.
Well, what was the sexual orientation? I kind of glossed over that. What was the relation?
He just says, on appeal, Rines relied on the notes to argue anti-gay prejudice had influence on the juror's sentencing decision. That's all.
So he was gay.
I'm assuming, based on that, yeah, that he was gay. I don't know that it actually said he is, but with that in there. But yeah,
no, I just when people make their final statement, I seldom hear of them. Of course, I'm not in favor of the death penalty, but people who make their final statement, I've rarely heard them. Usually they ask for the family to forgive them, and they say, you know, that they wish they had never done that. But for him to say, I'm forgiving the family, I thought that was kind of cute.
All right. Well, then let's move over to the Detroit Free Press. That is bills to expand criminal record expungement pass Michigan House. Now, then I would wonder if it's going to pass the other side of the of Congress up there. But this lets people with certain sentences, certain crimes, convictions, and after a certain period of time, seal their records down. That sounds like a good thing to me.
I thought I had put another article in, and if I didn't, feel free to give me grief for this, but there was another article that followed this because it had passed the House, and it said that that it's now in the Senate, and there were some Republican senators trying to weaken it, kind of like on the First Step Act, where we had the Republican opposition to the bipartisan agreement.
I do remember seeing something like that, where they had the voting numbers. I seem to remember seeing
Well, this
that.
Was overwhelming. This was on the House side. This was extremely – there was only a few in opposition. But I thought I had another article in here that said that in the Senate that there's some Republican opposition springing up. And that if I'm wrong about, we'll retract it next week. But if I'm right about it, I would caution people that you need to let those holdouts, like Tom Cotton in Arkansas at the federal level, he was the leader of that six or eight Republican senators who thought the First Step Act went too far. You need to let the people in Michigan know that are trying to weaken this progress, that you don't agree with them, because they won't know that you don't agree with them if you don't tell them you don't agree with them, particularly if you live in the districts of the ones who were in opposition to this going too far. That they say this goes too far. And like I said, I thought I had put a link in here to an article, but I don't see it.
I remember reading it where, but I did remember reading that there was Republican holdout over there too. It is possible that I deleted it, or one of us deleted it while we were getting ready for tonight.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure there's something in there with some, like, I mean, it's like 90 to 10 as far as the support. And so one guy, as I recall, and I could be wrong on this, was saying something like, well, why won't you let my DUI conviction off of have their record expunged? I seem to remember a quote like that in the other article. That's interesting. Let me ask you this question there. In regards to this, if we would relate this over to people's credit, that after a period of time, things fall off your credit and your recent payment history has a significant amount of influence over what your credit score is. why wouldn't we treat your criminal record so that, you know, if it's 1 year past your conviction, well, yeah, we would weigh that heavily. But if it was 20 years ago, like, A, maybe it does get not necessarily expunged, but sealed, and people don't necessarily find it. Why don't we maybe model our criminal justice history system sort of like the credit system?
Well, I agree with that, but you have a lot of pushback from the business community on this. And I know that our people are big business, is good for the country. What's good for, used to be the slogan, what's good for GM is good for the country, when GM was so large. But big business says that they need this information because they're potentially responsible for negligent hiring decisions. And the fact of the matter is, if it's a part of who the person is, they say that your past is a part of who you are. If we don't have that information, we can't make good decisions that we're ultimately responsible for. So you got a lot of pushback from the business community. And I don't know how to overcome that because, you know, being that I'm such a horrible anti-capitalist, as some have said, I don't know how to get through to reach them. But that's where a lot of the pushback comes from. But I agree that's what we should do. And that's what this bill does. This bill, as it's gone through the House, would make automatic expungement for certain felonies after 10 years and misdemeanors after 7 years.
Right,
and it would allow for expungement of marijuana offense if the offense would not have been a crime if committed for use of recreational marijuana, and it goes on with all these different categories of what it will do, and don't let the train wreckers wreck it on the other side of the rotunda. You know, there's momentum, apparently very good bipartisan momentum, and let's keep it going because this is what we need. We need these things to automatically happen, like you're talking about. And that's where this legislation was headed. You don't need to have to file for an expungement. You don't need to have to spend money for a clemency and all this stuff. You need, after a period of time, for what you did to be no longer relevant to who you are today.
I have a funny little story to share with you. There's a big box distribution center in the area. And I was speaking to someone that works there about two other people. One of them got the job, and they had a record, and they were only there for a matter of days. Then I think like the higher ups, like the corporate side of shit canned them. But then there's another person there that's a complete slug, like doesn't want to work, won't do anything, but there's no felony there. And that person gets to stay. And I mean, this is the bottom of the barrel as far as like just manual labor, moving boxes around and stuff like that. But so the person with the record, I'm going to project that this person's like, man, I got to get any job possible, and I will be the best employee possible. Just give me a chance. And just because of the record, the person gets canned. And this other person who doesn't have a record, but is lazy as all get out, and they keep that person around.
That is correct. And my friend that when we do the secret bunker that has the small Indian business, he learned that lesson himself. He's downsized because of age and the fact that the business is dying in that line of work. But he had a few employees at one time, and he took one that was on work release. Okay. I think he was in work release in either Clayton or Henry County, but one of the counties nearby there. And while that guy was on work release, his attendance was fantastic. He managed to get out of that jailhouse and make it to the job site on time, spry, ready to work. And he didn't want that mystery meat that they served at the jailhouse. He wanted to get his own food on the way into work. And once he got off work release, once that time expired, his work ethic deteriorated significantly he didn't no longer have to. When you're on work release, every hour that you can convince them that you're working gets you out of the jail.
That's true.
So you're magically, you're working 12-hour days. So, well, I have to be there at 7 in the morning, and they don't let me out till 6:30 in the evening or whatever. As long as you can milk it, that's what you would do. So he worked as many hours as he could. But magically, when he was no longer on work release, then he gravitated back to the norm. And that's the point you're making. The person who had a probation officer to satisfy and cost to pay if they were under any type of supervision, they would probably be a very dependable worker. More so than the person who doesn't have those barriers around them, the requirements. So, I would tend to want to give the person a chance if it were reasonable. I mean, what risk do you have in a warehouse?
I got nothing. I got nothing as to why there would be a risk in that particular violent environment. It's a crap environment, it sounds like to me.
So, but yes,
like you were just saying, the business pushback, their liability of having that felon, somebody with a record on their campus, I guess that outweighs the humanitarian side of it, the empathy side of it.
Well, if they were doing an individualized analysis, I would have less objection. If they just have a policy, we don't have any felons, period. That's overbroad. But
that is what this property management does.
Well, when I did property management, it was all individualized analysis. And of course, it had to be subjective. And the person, I had one snarky tenant say, well, who makes the decision? I said, well, I do. Who else would? You know, I'm the general manager. I make the decision. But we would look at the totality of everything that we could get a hold of about the person in terms of what their offense actually entailed. And that meant their defender's version plus the other versions that existed. And we looked at what they had done in the way of prison behavior as a consideration. And we looked at what, if they had been out, if they were not trying to come straight out to our property, we looked at how they had performed in other residential environments, whether it be a halfway house or whether it be living in the community. And we took all of that into consideration, along with the financial considerations of their ability to meet the obligations, and we made a decision. Well, depending on the type of crime they had, you might say, gee, I just don't think that's going to be within a risk tolerance level we just can't do that. But there are a lot of crimes. I mean, I wouldn't have any problem having Martha Stewart as a felon, would you?
I mean, if she's cooking, man, I think everyone's going to be happy.
I mean, so all felonies are not, but on the other hand, you probably would have a little bit of trepidation if Charlie Manson had made parole. You would have, well, let's say he has been in prison. I mean, he's dead now, but this is an academic. Yeah. But if they had realistically considered him for parole, and you look at the heinous nature of the crimes, and then you would take into account a lot of considerations about what he did in prison. Well, all during the prison, he never expressed any remorse. He always said, I think Geraldo Rivera interviewed him, and he said, I just might kick your ass right here in this prison. Everything that you saw about him and the evidence you could gather suggested that he did not see things any differently. So that would be one you probably wouldn't want to consider as a reintegrating potential that you would make that allowance for. So it's all situational.
I would also think that you wouldn't want stock advice from Martha Stewart. You wouldn't want her managing your portfolio.
Well, I don't know. She did pretty well, didn't she?
I think she did well, but she didn't necessarily make the most. Well, she was unknown about the. I think that's really. I'm being kind of snarky, but so don't allow Charles Manson to be alone with anybody, perhaps. But maybe he could. He could be a good a meat clerk, kind of, you know, at the meat counter. A butcher, probably. Just saying.
All right. I don't know that I want him with sharp instruments.
That's what I'm saying. So keep him behind the other side of the wall there. Anyway. All right. So let's move over to this final article before we have some extra content to cover. This is from the AJC. And this is Georgia is set to execute Ray Jeff Cromartie on November 13th. The last thing there in this article is that if there's controversy over whether he or the other person is the actual one that committed the murder, and the victim's daughter is in favor of a DNA test, why wouldn't our system say, sure, we're interested in justice? Why wouldn't we go ahead and do some sort of DNA test to actually verify before we nuke the guy?
Well, these people, I mean, they're just always grasping for straws, and it's appeal after appeal. He knows he done it, and I don't know why your bleeding hearts come in here, and you're always, always wanting. I mean, where does it end? What would you want next after a DNA test? It'll be something else you'll want. I mean, he's convicted. His appeals have been denied. Execution date's been set. What more do we have to do to satisfy?
I would think that we would err on the side of keeping someone alive as opposed to indiscriminately nuking people.
Well, he's not being indiscriminately nuked. He's been found guilty and his appeals have all failed. Well, so that's not indiscriminate.
Considering that it's Georgia in the 90s, black guy, I'm going to throw some sort of claim out there that it was possibly not an impartial jury.
No.
Yeah, I know. Right? Right? And so, Georgia is one of the execution states. So this is the 74th since 1976.
So yes, they run in the top five states of executions. And again, there's your South. That's where the executions happen in the United States. But Georgia has been on the forefront. And former corrections, what do they call them, secretary? They don't call them secretary in Georgia. The commissioner of corrections, former corrections commissioner, Dr. Alan Ault.
Oh, you brought him up before.
So, yes, who oversaw many executions in his various careers as running corrections departments in Georgia and I think Mississippi maybe and maybe another state. I think he was head of corrections in three states. He said it just doesn't provide people the closure that they're looking for. And he was worried that that they may have executed some people who shouldn't have been executed. This is an example of that when I take out my sarcasm.
Yes.
This is an example where we want to get this right because we can give people financial compensation, but if it turns out that it's proven later that he did not do the deed, I'm not sure that we're going to have a lot of recourse if he's executed. And he's on the schedule for this coming week.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I'm not a fan. They nuked somebody while I was at Jackson once, while I was in my little 10-week stay there. So that was kind of, you didn't know what happened, but I mean, like I knew because I was listening to the radio, I was listening to NPR at the time. So I knew that it was coming down the pike. But you know, it's not like the lights dimmed in the prison while they did it, but.
I was going to ask you all those TV shows, they show the lights flickering. Yes, so they don't exactly. Actually flicker.
No, not as far as I knew, but they barely had any lights on it. I mean, the electric bill in this place had to have been, my electric bill at my house probably is less than what it was at Jackson State Prison, because there's no air conditioning, there's nothing going on at that place that would be anything, a modicum of modern day creature comforts of any sort.
I thought I had been told that facility is air conditioned. Is that not the case?
They have some air conditioned places, like when the kitchen people work, they're air conditioned, but the dorm, at least not where I was.
Well, I guess that'll teach you not to want to come back.
No shit. It was hot. Well, I shouldn't even say it was hot because I got there, I think about this time. Let's see. Yeah, I got to Jackson about this time of year, and it was getting cold, and they were like passing out all kinds of extra blankets and stuff when I was there.
So they did have compassion for cold, just not for heat.
I don't know. And they pass out all kinds of extra blankets and stuff.
So well, I've known that to be a battle for some correctional officials because they say those blankets can be used for weapons and they back in the day they would burn. Maybe they're using more fire retardant, but they when people were allowed to smoke, they said they can build bonfires. But we can't give these inmates more than one blanket.
Yeah. And they actually then said, well, you have two jumpsuits, like two, the onesies, whatever the hell you want to call them. So wear both of them. I'm like, wow, that's where we are. We got to wear two sets of clothes, put on 17 pairs of socks, sleep with your boots on and put blankets on so you can stay some level of warm, and it didn't really work that well.
I don't see a problem with that. You should have thought about that.
I know, right? I knew that was coming. Should have thought of that. All right, let's. So all of that is all said and done. We received an email message from a listener, from a brand new listener this past week, talking about that you are sending our people down a very dangerous path of that they should just be flipping and go, psh, I don't have to register when I go into these other places. I'm going to stay as long as I want. I don't care. And I know I'm mischaracterizing it, but that's kind of sort of the gist of what it is. And we are providing you the floor and the opportunity to clarify what you mean by all these things.
Well, he said that what I don't think I'm doing, but he certainly can interpret that way. What I'm telling people is, and first of all, he said that Georgia requires that. I cannot find that in the Georgia statute where you're required to notify them about a state travel. And I've got a very current version of the official code of the state of Georgia, 42-1-12, sexual offender registry. And it goes on for 29 pages. And I can't find where out-of-state travel is required notice. Now, it could be that if you want to read and try to invent a requirement, you could try to read something in there that isn't there. But if it's in that if it's in there, I would like for that listener to point to me to the subsection so that I can become more familiar with Georgia Registry. So I don't see a requirement. Now, having said that, the feds do ask the states to put that in as one of the checkoffs in the AWA compliance. So if you're going to comply with federal law, that would be one of the measures that they would look at to see if your state was substantially compliant. So absences for 7 or more days, they do ask that that be a part of your statutory scheme. I believe that's one word that there's a workaround, because if you're substantially compliant, doesn't mean absolute compliance. So therefore, some states have put that into their statutory scheme that absences more than 7 days that you have to file notice. I'm not aware of that being in the Georgia law. So in terms of what you need to do for your state where you're registered at, you need to comply with the law of that state, whatever it is, but don't invent things that are not there. If it's there, I urge you to comply with it. But if the tax rate is 17%, I'm wondering how many people would pay 35%. So if you're not required to file a travel itinerary, that would mean that no prosecution could ensue for failing to do that. Therefore, if someone asked me, do I have to do that? I would say, no, you don't have to, because the law doesn't require it. But you're certainly welcome to do that. If you want to feel good about yourself, and if you want to go to the sheriff's office, and you want to spend a half a day, and if you want to give your private itinerary where you're going to go, all that, that's fine. I don't have any problem with a person doing that. But I don't think it's a requirement in the state of Georgia that you do that. Now, then there's the flip side of where – go ahead.
Well, I want to clarify, you're not a lawyer providing legal advice. You are just – a incredibly savvy legal expert, but you are not saying here is the legal, like you are authorized to do this because you're a lawyer.
Well, I'm not giving anybody legal advice. I'm looking at the statute, which I'm allowed to do in America. I'm allowed to have an opinion. And I have an opinion reading through the registration statute in Georgia. I have not been able to zero in on the section that requires you to do that. So if he can cite to that section, I would come back on the next episode and say, well, actually, in Georgia law, it says that if you're going to be absent more than 7 days, that you have to do that. But I can't find it. So I can opine that I can't see it. And I can opine, if it's not in the law, that I don't think that you can be prosecuted successfully. Because in order for there to be subject matter jurisdiction to take a plea of guilty, someone has to say on behalf of the state of Georgia that the accused didn't do this as required by this section of law. And if it's not in the law, I don't know what they would cite to. They would provide the subject matter jurisdiction to take a plea.
And
so that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. And just like there's the 72-hour thing where it says if you change your residence, like where you sleep for 72 hours, that's if you're changing residence. Like I have now moved out of this apartment and I've moved into another apartment. That would be the 72-hour requirement.
Well, that's what it appears to say. It doesn't say if you're going to be out of the state that you must file an itinerary. But changes are required within 72 hours. But being out of the state on a visit, in my estimation, is not the same as saying you will file advance notice of out-of-state travel. That's what he alleges that he does. And he's okay. I'm okay with him doing that. Except it's not required. So I can't see it in the statute. But then there's the other side of when you leave a state for a visit to go to another state, you could fall within the zone of registration, depending on how many hours you're in that state.
And every one of them is different.
There are a lot of differences. I can't tell you how many have, but it could be anywhere from as little as 48 hours to, like in the state of Georgia, if you're there 14 continuous days or a cumulative of 30, it's going to trigger a registration obligation for an out-of-stater. Again, what I said is that for if you're in the state of Nevada for 49 hours and 12 minutes, I'm saying there will not be a plume of radiation that will surge out of your body in that hour and 12 minutes. That's what I'm saying. Now, if somebody can prove that I'm wrong, that there is a surge of radiation and there is a plume that goes out of your body, I would like to see evidence of that. But there is no such plume of radiation that goes out of you that causes a hovercraft to come in and encircle you and say, we're going to keep this beam on you until we get law enforcement to pick you up. So, and I also have said that I have not found any evidence of a prosecution for a person, because even as bad as law enforcement is, and I'm freely criticize law enforcement, I have not known of a case that dubious where they said, we got you, 48 hours and 17 minutes. Could it be possible? Yes, it certainly could be possible. But since usually you have to jump through some hoops of knowing, and there's 50 different knowing requirements around the country because the registration, there's no uniformity in how long you can be in a particular state. My experience tells me that they would tell you to get registered once you admitted you had been there more than 48 hours. They would do what listeners have told us. I think we've even had a listener that told us that just recently, didn't we? He encountered them in Nebraska, and they told him that we do see you're registered. I mean, you're registered in another state, and if you're going to be here beyond whatever it is, you need to register. But I have not seen a person prosecuted for being 12 minutes later. But again, it's personal choice.
Absolutely.
If you're going to Nevada for 3 days and you feel like that there will be a potential for a problem and you want to spend 6 hours on the front side of your visit checking in with the Clark County Sheriff and you want to spend 6 hours on the backside, I encourage you to do precisely that. If you want to set yourself up where you're on the registry of 40 other states where they don't remove you after you leave, which they don't in Florida, they don't in Nevada, if you want to do that, I encourage you to do exactly that if that makes you have peace of mind.
Well, very good. I wanted to address that for sure. Is there any other content? I seem to think I'm missing something as far as covering all of the things for the evening.
I think we've covered it all, and we've had a nice episode tonight.
I do want to, before we shut this MF down, I wanted to give a shout out. I saw a bunch of our people and friends of our people. There was a conference going on in Atlanta this weekend. I went up there and spent some time with them, and I'm saying hi to everybody that came from Colorado and Iowa and Oklahoma and New England, Boston, wherever he's from. Where's Richard from? Is he from Boston?
He's from New Hampshire, but he goes to the harbor.
And then a new guy, we got a new listener. He's up there. His name is Bill, and he's in Ohio.
Ohio?
Yep. So hello to everybody.
So that's kind of like me saying hi. So Ohio, everybody.
And without I can't forget how to do all this. Larry, how can we grow the podcast? So this applies to all of you people that aren't getting us 47,000 Twitter followers like that dude that's the vigilante justice guy. How can we grow the podcast?
Well, from what it sounded like you were saying, you need to share the podcast.
That is what we need everyone to do. Go find all of your social media platforms and tell them we exist. So go find people on Facebook, Reddit, Twitter. I don't care. Tell them that we exist. That's important.
But as you pointed out, a lot of people who are not impacted by this won't care about that. So how do you narrow it down to the population's that's interested? Wouldn't it be like in group therapy?
I think that would be a stellar place. Like, hey, anybody that's in treatment, why don't you say, hey, there's this podcast that deals with our issue. Maybe you should give it a listen.
We had a listener do that, and he turned it to his therapist, and she listened to it and said that we were the Antichrist, and said that she would not encourage anyone to listen to us because I guess I must have, after listening to a couple of episodes, she heard me bash law enforcement and said, gee, this is a kook that we don't want our people listening to.
I can second the nature of that kook thing. But all right, so how can we have people grow the podcast? Where can they find it, Larry?
They can find it if they're on the internet and they put in their search engine Registry Matters, or they can just go registrymatters.co, and that'll take them right to our page.
And then how about a phone number to call in and leave a voicemail message?
Yeah, we're going to disconnect this phone if we don't start getting more messages.
I could shut it down.
747-227-4477.
And then how about emailing us?
And those all go to you. That's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And how about supporting the podcast? And we love our supporters. We love all of our listeners, but the ones that support us, we give out extra love.
We do indeed. And that's patreon.com/registrymatters, or just patreon.com, and you can search for us.
And one final question.
How do you spell Patreon?
P-A-T-R-E-O-N.
All right.
I have a quick question for you.
All right.
Is there a technical definition of FYP?
It's not very technical, no. I would say that it would be very untechnical, in fact.
Got it. All right, we're done. That's it. We're out. Have a great night, Larry.
So, and thank you, everyone, for being so supportive. And we're going to be at 100 by the end of the year for Patreon. For patrons.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great night. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Good night.